Welcome to The Point on WCAI. I'm Steve Junker. It's Friday, October 4th, and this is our weekly news roundup when we discuss some of the top local news stories of the week with colleagues in the print and digital media. Joining me in the studio is WCAI Sarah Mises-Tan. Good morning, Sarah.
Good morning, Steve.
And from the Cape Cod Times, we have with us Ethan Genter.
Morning,
thanks,
Steve,
for making the trip to Woods Hole,
Absolutely.
Ethan.
Absolutely.
And joining us later in the program will be Noah Asimo from the Vineyard Gazette. We'll speak with Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle, Ed Miller at the Provincetown Independent, Josh Balling at the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror, Brian Dowd at the Martha's Vineyard Times, and we'll check in with our State House team, Catherine Ident and Mike Dean, and we'll hear from Sam Houghton in the studio. Busy program in store for us now. Let's take a look at some of the news here around the Cape and the Islands. The Silent Spring Institute, which is a nonprofit that looks at environmental toxins, announced the results of the first phase of a study of private wells on Cape Cod. Sarah, you were there for this on Wednesday. The big number that struck a lot of people was how many wells tested positive for PFAS contamination.
So I guess first, it's good to say that they tested 101 private wells across Cape Cod last winter, and they found that 48% of those wells, so nearly half of those private wells, tested positive for at least one type of PFAS chemical. Also, 28% of the wells had two or more types of PFAS chemicals detected. It's good to note that none of these wells exceeded the EPA guidelines, which has a guideline of 70 parts per trillion of PFAS in a sample of water, though 3% of these private wells did exceed the state guideline, which is lower than the EPA's. That's 20 parts per trillion for six types of PFAS. And just for some reference, the highest concentration of PFAS that they found in these well samples was 25 parts per trillion, and a part per trillion is the equivalent of one grain of sand in an Olympic-sized swimming pool. So we're talking in very small amounts, but it also takes apparently just a very small amount for there to be adverse health effects.
Ethan, what do we know about the dangers of PFAS?
So they're definitely still something that we're still looking at. They're called the forever chemicals. They're associated a lot with they find them a lot in the water near airports, military bases. So around here, Barnstable Airport is a big one. I think the one out in the Vineyard as well, and Joint Base Cape Cod. And they kind of come from the non-stick, stain-resistant products, food packaging. Firefighter foams is the big one out here. I know they've put out health advisories for, I believe, pregnant women, small children drinking that kind of water in Hyannis. But it's definitely something that there's known kind of, there are adverse health effects, not exactly clear exactly what everything is still, and they're still studying the emerging contaminant, I think is what they call them.
It's not good to have this in the water,
yeah,
in short. This study was only phase one, Sarah. It will continue. What are they hoping to do in the next phase?
Sure. So they're hoping to test another 150 wells in the next phase, and they're also looking to expand their study into looking into the health effects PFAS has on humans, specifically how PFAS can affect the thyroid and liver of adults and how it can affect the immune system of younger children and how vaccinations can play into that. So they'll be testing 1,000 adults by taking urine and blood samples, and they'll also be looking at 300 children in Hyannis and also in Fort Devens in the northern part of the state.
Ethan, none of this was unexpected, is what how it was greeted, and yet it was a powerful amount of information for folks, particularly in that area. Tell us about the participants in this study and what people are looking. They're looking for more people to get involved here.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, so these were done in 12 capes on the town. A majority, I believe, were PFAS that were found were in the mid capes. You're talking Barnstable, Yarmouth, Dennis. The lowest was in the lower cape. It's this kind of thing. So this was done by STEEP. It stands for Sources, Transport, Exposure, and Effects of PFAS. Like you said, it's kind of not unexpected, but still, once you see these kind of numbers in front of you, it's obviously kind of a punch in the gut a little bit.
Now, Hyannis has already worked to respond to some of these concerns. They're installing a new filtration plant in Hyannis. It's not online yet, but it's coming, a new $12 million filtration plant. And Sarah, what else can you tell us about the PFAS?
Sure, yeah. You know, if people are concerned about how they can filter out PFAS mm-hmm. from their water, there are essentially two options. You can have a carbon filter. So something like a Brita filter should take out most PFAS, though you do need to make sure that it's updated. And of course, they say, if you want to use a carbon filter, make sure that you're putting it on your entire filtration system in your house and not just having a pitcher. And they also say reverse osmosis filtration, which is a little more involved and actually does create wastewater itself. They say that is an effective way to remove PFAS also. Both are fairly pricey, though, but two options.
People who want to get involved in the next round who are in the study area can reach out to the Silent Spring Institute?
Yes, they can reach out to the Silent Spring Institute.
That's WCAI Sarah Mises-Tan. Sarah, thanks for joining us this morning.
Thanks so much, Steve.
Ethan, big story out yesterday, came out yesterday evening. The Army Corps of Engineers is recommending replacement for the Bourne and Sagamore bridges. In some ways, not a surprise at all, but it is a significant statement of intention, maybe the most significant we've seen yet from the Army Corps of Engineers.
Yeah, I mean, I personally, as a transportation geek, I can't think of a bigger story around here. But yeah, absolutely. So they came out with, it's called the Army Corps has been working on this study for at least since 2016, I think earlier, looking at, they're weighing, these bridges are 84 years old. So they're trying to decide, is it better to do a kind of a major rehab on them or replace them? They also looked at a bunch of other alternatives, but it was kind of weighing that. And then this draft study that came out last night suggested it's more cost effective to build two new bridges instead of doing major rehabilitation on them.
This came down, like you say, last night, and what they're proposing here is much wider than what we have, no surprise. Explain for us a little bit the scale of what's being proposed.
So if you think about it, this bridge was built, these two bridges were built in the 1930s, and they're 84 years old now. So if you think about kind of how big a car was at that time versus the Land Rovers and SUVs and trucks that we get coming across daily now, these bridges are much too narrow.
So the lanes on the bridges right now, I think they say they're 10 feet wide.
Correct. And they want to widen them to about 12 feet, which is more in line with modern standards for transportation. So their plan is, the recommendation that came in this plan was two lanes on either side, through lanes all the way through, plus an auxiliary lane on each side. Shoulders, which we don't have the luxury of right now. A median, again, which we don't have the luxury now. And a pedestrian lane, which we kind of have now. Mm-hmm. It's not separated, which is what they were proposing to do in this.
This is a draft proposal, which means that they are just kind of putting this out here, but they have kind of a quick timeline to try to move this forward.
Yeah, so they're taking public comment starting, I think the first one starts on the 16th. They're going to Bourne, Eastham, Hyannis, even Boston, and Plymouth. And they're going to be doing it, they want to kind of finalize everything by 2020, I believe. And then they're saying construction could start possibly as early, and this is, I mean, you need funding, you need congressional stuff, possibly as early as 2025.
Could be $1 billion to build these bridges?
Yeah, that's kind of been the number that's been floating around for a while, $1 billion. We haven't got an exact figure. There's also some other things that would have to go into this. They'd have to build these, in this report it says, they'd have to take land near the Sagamore and the Bourne. So you're talking about trying to redo all this and trying to acquire land. This would all have to be done in coordination with the Mass Department of Transportation to redo the roads on this side and the other side to kind of sync up with these bridges. So there's a lot of work that would have to go into this, but this is kind of, like you said, the first real concrete thing. The Army Corps has been saying kind of we're leaning towards replacing them, but
here they are saying this is what we think we should do.
Yeah, this is the strongest statement that they've ever come out with.
It was a week of reports. The next one came from the Nonprofit Association to Preserve Cape Cod, who released a report that says despite the good intentions and efforts of towns across the Cape, the water quality in most Cape ponds and bays is unacceptable.
Yeah, the vast majority, I think, of the lakes, ponds, said they weren't doing great. So 2/3 of the 48 bays and estuaries, which there was data for on this, had unacceptable water quality, and 64% of stations where water quality monitoring took place was also deemed unacceptable, which is kind of wild to think for a place where we kind of live off the water, pride ourselves on the water we have, to find that much is unacceptable.
They're pointing here to septic systems, nutrient runoff as kind of the biggest impact.
Yeah, so when you hear nutrients, I mean, it's not like your food nutrient, kind of how you think of it that way. It's stuff that goes into the water and then promotes kind of algae growth is one of the big things, and other kind of vegetations. And what that do is it slowly kind of chokes the water, kind of chokes a pond off, it blocks out light.
Those nutrients are feeding the algae, and it just
algae gets
grows
bigger and bigger.
So quickly.
Other types of vegetation, too. So it just kind of chokes the pond. It kills off fish that can't get the light and other plants that need the light. And it just kind of destroys the ecosystem. So that's one of the things I'm really worrying about. And like you said, a lot of the things come from septic, stuff like that. Unfortunately, I think only 3% of parcels on Cape Cod are serviced by wastewater treatment. Which is a cleaner way to handle these kind of things.
And there's a quote here from Andrew Gottlieb from the association who says that essentially we're doing what we did in the 1600s, still digging a hole in our backyard and pouring it in, meaning, you know, that's what a septic system is doing. It's running off. It's making its way. So much of those nutrients are making their way into the water systems.
Yeah, and I mean, some towns are trying to tackle this. It's an expensive tackle. You're talking hundreds of millions of dollars to build a sewer system, do other kinds of alternative technologies to help water flow and help improve water quality.
Cape has more than or about 1,000 ponds. That's a big number. When we think about the Cape, you often think about it as a saltwater kind of environment, but all these ponds are suffering from this nutrient runoff as well.
Yeah, and like that PFAS story, it's good to know in context, only about 15% are monitored for the water quality. So just kind of keep that in mind when you hear these kind of studies. A lot of the times, not every one of those ponds is being tested.
I want to ask you about a story that you covered this week, which is the state's Supreme Judicial Court. It held a special sitting on Cape Cod this week. This is the state's highest court. I didn't know it could be a traveling roadshow, but here it was on Cape Cod.
Yeah, apparently every year they go on field trips, and so they've been to Lawrence, New Bedford, I think Greenfield, and so on Wednesday they came down here to Barnstable Superior Court up there off Route 6A. And it was pretty wild. That's the busiest I've seen the court in my time here on the Cape. It was packed. There was a group of AP government students from Monomoy were in attendance. And a lot of people kind of wanted to see how this works. And that's why they do this. They come out, they come to these smaller communities that don't have the chance to kind of peek behind the curtain here and see how the highest court in the Commonwealth works.
So they heard four cases while they were here, and two of them had Cape connection.
Yeah, and I think that was part of the reason why they came here, is because they had, one was a murder appeal, and another was
the license plate readers.
The license plate readers on there, on the two bridges, which was an interesting case. There was another case about firearm discharging and negligence there. So yeah, it was pretty wild to hear kind of your own cases, and Barnstable Superior Court Judge Rufo had the chance to actually sit and listen to them talk about one of his cases that was on appeal. So I don't think Superior Court justices get that privilege very often.
The students who were there, it sounds like such a great idea. There was this class, as you say, that were there. And then they, after the court had its business, the students got to ask questions of the judges.
Yeah, so I was sitting in there, so the So there was only six there that day. There's normally seven. They came out, no robes, just kind of in there every day, working clothes, came out and took any kind of question. One of the students asked, how often are you actually in the courtroom? It turns out they're very little. Most of their time is spent writing, editing, going over, studying. I think they're only in once a week, a month. They said, don't take that as we only work four days a month. What got them into law? I mean, those were the kind of questions. They were pretty bright kids.
It sounded also like the law enforcement and the court officials just turned out in force because everybody was interested in this. I know the district attorney for the Cape and Islands was there, Michael O'Keefe. And you said Judge Rufo, there's a picture of him in the paper taking kind of a photograph of the event because it was just such an unusual chance to see this court sitting on Cape Cod.
Yeah, so normally they're in Boston, and so unless you have time to get up there and this and that, I mean, they don't sit at convenient hours for us. So it was a spectacle. Average Joes were there just to see it happen. Like you said, the DA was there. Defense attorneys whose cases weren't happening were there. State representatives were there. It was quite the scene.
This is the News Roundup. I'm Steve Junker. With us from the Cape Cod Times is Ethan Genter. We're going to the break now. When we come back, we will speak with Noah Asimow at the Vineyard Gazette. There's more in a moment. This is the News Roundup. On the Point, we're discussing the top local news stories of the week. I'm Steve Junker. With us right now is Noah Asimow from the Vineyard Gazette. Good morning, Noah.
Good morning, Steve.
Noah, the Edgartown Conservation Commission and the offshore wind company Vineyard Wind have come to terms on the laying of an undersea power cable. Now, this cable isn't even coming ashore on the Vineyard, so remind us why the commission was concerned and what they saw at stake here.
So the reason the Conservation Commission is involved at all is that Vineyard Wind plans to lay the cables, which these are pretty heavy-duty, 220 kilovolt cables, 1 mile off of Chappaquiddick. The parts that run through Edgartown, which are the parts that run right off Chappaquiddick, are subject to review by the Conservation Commission under the Wetlands Protection Act.
They're running about, what, a mile offshore?
A mile off, yeah. So close enough that they're within the jurisdiction of the town. And basically, this dispute dates back to the summer. The CONCOM held this marathon 5-hour public hearing on the cables in which probably a dozen commercial fishermen voiced concerns about the project and various unknowns associated with it. And then the CONCOM, in a total surprise vote, sided with the fishermen and denied the cable. So kind of where we are today is that Vineyard Wind appealed that decision, the Mass DEP issued a superseding order, and then the CONCOM appealed that. So it looks like the two sides have come to a settlement that tacks additional conditions on to the ones that the Mass DEP had issued earlier.
Well, tell us, what does this deal lay out to address those concerns?
Basically, the gist of the settlement is that the Edgartown Conservation Commission will kind of, for lack of a better term, get to keep their nose in the project even as it enters into its later permitting and construction phases. So any sort of environmental report on the cables, any sort of seafloor monitoring plan, any timeline change for installation, all that stuff now not only has to go to the state, but also has to come back to the Conservation Commission for consideration. A lot of the conditions basically are about environmental monitoring. That was one of the main concerns from the fishermen and from the Conservation Commission as well. So anything regarding the seafloor, they need to issue reports on the project 1 and 3 years after it's done. They need to let the town know if the cables that are being laid ever become exposed. Basically what they're doing is they're dredging an area underground and then laying the cables, and they want to make sure that they stay underground. So it's this, it's this litany of conditions. But on the other hand, none of the conditions appear to actually be so strenuous that they would in any way jeopardize the project or its viability.
And in the meantime, Vineyard Wind can't even get started with their offshore wind farm, despite having now most of all or all of their local permitting in place, because they're waiting on the feds.
Right, that's the thing. Regardless of what happens with the Edgartown Conservation Commission or, the Cape Cod Commission, the Barnstable Commission, they still need this environmental impact statement from the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management, which it looks like is going to be at least delayed until 2020, which means they won't get started until probably after. Basically, the reason for that is that they want to make sure, at least the federal government is saying they want to make sure that they're evaluating the cumulative impact of all offshore wind projects, which it looks like there's going to be quite a lot considering all the lease areas that they have been auctioning off. So there's really just kind of a lot of moving parts here, and even if on the local level they're looking good, they still have issues at the federal one.
Noah Asimow at the Vineyard Gazette. Noah, thanks for joining us this morning.
Yeah, thank you.
We're going to speak now with Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle. Good morning, Tim.
Hi, Steve.
Tim, neighbors of the Chatham Airport are attacking planned updates to the airport that they say will make it busier and change its character.
Yeah, about 150 people showed up at an airport commission meeting this past Monday. While the purpose of the session was to get public comment on an update of the airport's master plan, it was really clear that many of the people there were just unhappy with the airport in general.
Tim, let me jump in. 150 people. That's a lot of people to turn out to this kind of meeting.
That's a lot of people. They filled the largest meeting room in town at the community center with standing room only. People were holding signs out front before the meeting, you know, protesting changes to the airport. It's clear that the people are just really unhappy with the operations of the airport, but even more so the airport commission in particular. During the meeting, people accused the airport commission of only catering to the needs of private pilots and not taking seriously the concerns that townspeople have about the issues at the airport. Now, a lot of this is sort of residual fallout from the skydiving controversy that we've seen over the past several years. But a lot of people also believe that a new proposal from the Airport Commission as part of this master plan update that they're doing to change the way that planes land during inclement weather will have a really negative effect. Under the existing proposal, currently when the weather's bad in Chatham, which happens, you know, quite often with fog and everything, pilots when they make an instrument landing, they have to descend to about 600 feet and circle until they are able to visually land to see the runway and to land that way. Under the proposal, pilots could use a newer GPS technology to do a straight-in landing at the runway, which would bring them in from further out a little lower over the community before they hit the runway. Now, the airport commissioners say that this new pattern reduces the area that the pilots would fly over while trying to land during bad weather from about 11 acres, which is the area that they circle when they're trying to figure out if it's safe to land, to about an acre, and will be about 8 times safer and will also cut down on noise, because when the planes come in on a straight-in landing, they throttle back and almost glide in. While they're doing that circling maneuver, they have to keep the airport at full power in case they aren't able to land and have to move on to Barnstable or some other airport. But people didn't really buy that they didn't buy that argument. They said that this is going to convert Chatham from an airport where planes don't come in during bad weather as much to an airport that's going to be heavily used all the time, that it's going to allow bigger and larger and noisier aircraft to use the airport, which is, as the commission said, that the size of the airplanes that use the airport are governed by the length of the runway, and that's not going to change. So,
where does the plan go from here? So this is still in the draft stage, right?
They're still in a draft stage, and they haven't even actually completed the full master plan draft. They've got a couple sections to go, and once they complete those, the Airport Commission will hold a public open house session where people can come in and learn about the entire master plan and be able to submit comments. And after that, the commission will review all those comments, decide, take a final vote on the recommendations before they submit it to the Federal Aviation Administration, which has to approve the airport master plan as part of the facilities being able to continue to receive federal funding. Right now, they're doing the town just got a several million-dollar federal grant to redo the parallel taxiway at the airport, and that work is underway right now. So the airport's gotten $7 to $10 million in federal money over the years, and the town really wants to keep that ability to get that money available, and so that this master plan is important in that sense. But the commission, I'm sure, is going to get an earful from folks who feel that they need to, even if they have to finish the plan, they need to not make those major changes that they are recommending right now.
Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle. Tim, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Steve.
We're going to speak now with Ed Miller at the Provincetown Independent. Good morning, Ed.
Good morning, Steve. How are you?
Ed, the Truro Motor Inn has been in the news quite a bit recently. This has become a year-round residence, essentially, for low-income folks, but it's been operating against town codes. There was talk of shutting it down, but now it appears that it's gotten another reprieve.
Yes, there was a well-attended meeting last night of the Truro Board of Health, at which the board was considering revoking the license for the Truro Motor Inn, which would have resulted in the displacement of some 50 year-round residents there in 36 motel room units for a whole series of code violations, including a failed septic system, overloaded electrical circuits, and the fact that people are living in spaces that are actually too small, according to the town occupancy and zoning rules. But it's a very troubling case because the town officials involved don't want to put these people out on the street, and there's really there's such a shortage of affordable housing out on this part of the Cape that there's nowhere for them to go. So the board voted 4-1 at the end of their hearing last night to give the owner, Daniel Delgizzi of Braintree, another sort of one more chance to make the necessary repairs there before facing some kind of drastic action. And I think the issue here is that the town doesn't have a lot of options to enforce these rules, which are, of course, designed to protect the health and safety of the residents. One possibility that was mentioned by the town council is that the town could petition the Massachusetts Housing Court to take the motel property into receivership, and that would give it the power to use the rent that the owner is collecting, estimated at $400,000 a year, to carry out the necessary repairs. So this is a story we're going to have to follow to see what the town can really do to rectify this situation.
Ed Miller from the Provincetown Independent. Ed, thank you for joining us this morning.
Welcome, Steve. You're welcome. Take care.
And now we speak with Josh Balling at the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror. Good morning, Josh.
Good morning.
Josh, a false alarm at the school caused some harrowing moments for students, faculty, and parents this week. Tell us what happened there.
It did. It was more than a few moments, unfortunately, too. It was about an hour-long lockdown at Nantucket High School. It actually ended up being a malfunction in the high school security system that caused that lockdown Friday afternoon, and it did result in a massive emergency response. Teachers and students were barricading themselves in classrooms. Some even took to the roof of the school to escape what they thought might be a shooter in the building.
There was an alert, right? They came out saying there was an active shooter in the high school.
But it was active. I think what really sort of happened is when the emergency response, it was they were asked to go into active shooter protocol to presume that there was an active shooter. What happened was there was a panic alarm that went off at the high school that went out, told the students and the staff that it was not a drill, and school officials did not know where it had come from. They were unable to determine the cause of that for the first 15, 20 minutes, even more, half hour or so. So they were treating it like it was an active alert. Some students fled the grounds. They went to the Nantucket Boys and Girls Club, the Cumberland Farms Convenience Store, Cape Cod 5 Bank. But it ended up turning out that panic alarm at the high school was tripped by workers doing maintenance on the school-wide security system at the elementary school, which is about a quarter mile down the road. And they had no idea. They were completely unaware of what they had done, school officials said, and it took about half hour, 45 minutes until they realized that that's probably what it was. The lockdown in and of itself lasted just under an hour. One student even broke their leg while they were attempting to exit the building through a window.
Mm. What was the final outcome now? School officials were kind of saying, in essence, this proof that their system is in place and working.
They were. The school officials and the police department, while, you know, they hold drills, but drills are never, unfortunately, the real thing, and they hope they never have to experience the real thing. This, for about a half an hour, was considered to be the real thing, and they said that the lockdown protocols worked exactly the way they were supposed to. The police chief even said that when his officers entered the high school to clear the building, the hallways were empty. He said it looked like a ghost town. That meant that all the students and staff were inside the classrooms with the doors locked and barricaded like they were supposed to be, and it did work. A lot of parents did come to the school to check on their children, and that's something that the school officials are addressing. Some of them did actually come right up to the building, started peering in the windows and knocking on the windows, which ended up frightening a lot more students than it helped. But it's certainly understandable. Both school officials and police say that, you know, while it's not the protocol they would like to see, they can certainly understand why parents would immediately come to the school when they understand a situation like this is happening.
Let me ask you about another story you have. Town meeting on the island is getting some modern technology. This is in the interest of increasing efficiency?
Increasing efficiency and speed primarily, and maybe even encouraging some more attendance at town meeting. No longer, at least on this coming town meeting in April, will the act of raising your hand to vote or shouting out aye or nay is going to happen on Nantucket at town meetings. An electronic voting system is coming in. The select board approved the move last week, arguing that hopefully at the very least it will make the often 4 or 5 hour meetings more efficient and more accurate as well, although no one has been able to actually pinpoint cases where accuracy of a hand count or a voice vote was actually in question. Often when there's a voice vote that seems too close to call, the moderator will call for a hand count, and those have never been challenged. But basically it'll work like this. A registered voter is entering the high school auditorium. Will each be given an electronic clicker, and for each article and proposal that's called for debate, a 30-second voting window to vote will be opened when the debate has ended. Voters can either click yes or no, or not touch the button at all if they choose not to vote, and those results will be electronically counted. Town officials say they've spoken with officials in other towns like Wayland, Brookline, and Lexington that use the system, and they say at the very least it has definitely sped up their meetings. The other thing that town officials are talking about, however, in light of a special town meeting last October that was very poorly attended, are ways to increase attendance. They're hoping that maybe with this more anonymous system, some voters might be more encouraged to attend. But they're also exploring, or at least talking about exploring, a change in the form of town government here on Nantucket, from an open town meeting to either a mayoral, a town council, or a representative town meeting. But going to start with the electronic voting and see where it goes from there.
Josh Balling from the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror. Josh, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And now we're going to speak with Brian Dowd at the Martha's Vineyard Times. Good morning, Brian.
Morning, Steve.
Brian, shell fishermen on the island got a chance to speak out about some unpopular legislation at a recent meeting. Tell us what they're talking about and what's at stake here for them.
Sure. So former state senator Robert O'Leary held a joint meeting with scientist Chris Shalashi Monday night in Vineyard Haven, and it was about the Massachusetts Shellfish Initiative, which is a state-advised think tank and advocacy group for shellfish harvesters. They came to the island to get opinions from island fishermen and to get on all aspects of local shellfishing, issues, concerns that they may have. But before getting into a lot of the nitty-gritty shellfish topics, O'Leary and Shalashi addressed kind of the elephant in the room, which is House Bill 746. This is a bill that was put forth by State Rep Josh Cutler, and it seeks to allow aquaculture licenses to be sold, gifted, or bequeathed.
Which is not how aquaculture licenses are treated right now.
Correct. And the reasoning behind the bill is that say a shell fisherman has a license, and then they work on a farm and they want to pass it down to maybe their child or whoever works there later on, so that it gets passed down. But it hasn't really gotten a lot of support from local fishermen, not only on the vineyard but in other communities as well. And the, for example, in Chatham, there was a similar hearing held, and a lot of the shell fishermen there were not happy with it, mostly because they see it as a law that would essentially end local control over aquaculture leases. It would put a lot of the power in the state's hands and would take it away from local communities. So there's not a lot of support from shellfish harvesters.
Let me ask you about another story you have, which is pretty neat. Automatic traffic counters are being installed at a number of locations on the island. What are they after here?
So anyone listening, if they've ever been to the vineyard in July and August, you'll know that there's a lot of traffic all over the place. And so the Martha's Vineyard Commission got state and federal transportation improvement program TIP funding which allows them to put in these traffic counters at strategic places around the island. There's six of them, and they're going to be permanent, so they're going to be here hopefully for a very long time. And it'll give they're pretty sophisticated machines, and they'll give the Martha's Vineyard Commission the ability to track not only the number of vehicles that are going along vineyard roads, but also the type of vehicle, kind of how fast they're going, traffic patterns and all this. And what it's going to do is it's going to give the public, because it'll be available to the public as well, it'll give them a lot more information on what's going on that they can download straight from the Martha's Vineyard Commission website. But it'll also give towns and the commission a lot of data that they can use to kind of back up when they apply for back themselves up when they apply for grants or even more funding in the future.
Brian Dowd from the Martha's Vineyard Times. Brian, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
This is the News Roundup on The Point. I'm Steve Junker. It's time now to check on action at the State House. There's a lot to keep up on Beacon Hill as lawmakers respond to the governor's ban on vape products, try to close out a bill to ban the use of handheld devices while driving, and push an education funding bill. WCAI's Catherine Iden talked with our State House reporter Mike Dean for an update.
Good morning, Mike.
Good morning, Catherine.
As we know, the governor banned vape products for 4 months, and that story made a big splash last week when he made the announcement. And we've heard since then from some tobacco sellers about their displeasure with the ban. Where are senators and representatives on this? What are they saying? Might we see some legislation on vaping in the near future?
We might. Baker's trying to get to the bottom of these respiratory illnesses that are going around the country. What is happening on the legislative side is they're almost piggybacking on this respiratory illness urgency to add kind of some emphasis to bills they already had in the works to ban flavored tobacco and nicotine products, including vapes. And this is kind of an outgrowth of ideas about marketing to children. So what's happening now is that the Speaker of the House has said that he wants to move some kind of vape bill that would probably be based around this flavor ban. The Speaker wants to be even more comprehensive. He wants to add some public safety measures onto the not just the flavor ban, but also maybe even add taxes. Vapes are not taxed the way other tobacco products are. Leo might see some dollar signs in that when vapes get back on the market come January.
I want to switch now to another story, and that is the massive education spending bill, where lawmakers could pass anywhere up to $1.7 billion, depending, to fund districts across the state over the next 7 years. Already, Republicans are hoping to increase accountability. Are they going to try to make some changes to this bill? We talked a lot about how it really had broad support.
It does. This is the rare example of a bill that starts with the House Speaker and the Senate President in agreement. And I should say most of the interested parties all agree that this bill is a good idea and it needs to go. Certain people have certain ideas about tweaking it here and there. Teachers' unions have certain things that they want to do to clarify some of the language about the state's role in, turnaround plans for districts, things like that. And that's also the area where Governor Baker is most concerned. He thinks that there should be more, quote unquote, strings attached. If the state's going to give more money into this newly rewritten formula, then there should be newer and more modern accountability put forward in the new law. Teachers' unions will argue that the existing accountability things, those are working fine. It's just the amount of money and where that money goes needs to be, modernized. But Republicans in the legislature are going to be, trying to emulate the ideas that Baker wants. So that means amending the bill when it's debated on the floor. And so we're going to see a House debate in the coming weeks where you could see Republicans like, Minority Leader Brad Jones kind of going to bat for Baker with an amendment that makes it far more palatable to the governor. Whether or not something like that passes could mean a lot and shed a lot of light onto whether or not Baker will sign the bill at the end of the day when it reaches his desk.
We've talked a lot about this, and that is the hands-free driving bill, and it would ban cell phone use while driving. Any updates on the status of this bill?
Still not law. I can give you that status update. As far as the process, it is still sitting there in conference committee. This thing has gone so far into the weeds, we kind of have to put the idea of distracted driving aside for a moment and focus on what the conflict here is. And that is how public should information data about traffic stops be. The simple thinking here is from, you know, the ACLU and certain civil rights organizations in the Senate is saying that if we give police a new stopping power, that will exacerbate the existing racial profiling problem that happens in Massachusetts, where, you know, Black and Latino drivers are harassed disproportionately to white drivers. And so what they want is more data to prove that there is a racial profiling problem in the state, in certain police districts, in cities and towns, things like that. And the way to get that would be to make it public so that it can be studied, etc. The House says that that would actually be a violation of drivers' privacy. It's not just affecting the Black and Latino drivers. This is going to be race and gender and location data for every driver that gets stopped. And that is just too much to make public because, you know, it could be manipulated, it could be leaked out, so, you know, other things, even though there's no names or addresses attached, there could be enough personal information that you could connect the dots. So advocates are trying to find some middle ground on the racial profiling issue, and in the meantime, the distracted driving bill, that pretty simple ban on using your phone while driving, remains locked out.
You know, there was some talk of House Speaker Robert DeLeo saying that they might just split it up and just take it right out of the bill. Is there any feeling or word that that actually could happen and move this?
What is not happening from the Speaker or the Senate President is a commitment to taking up a racial profiling bill later on in the session. And without a commitment to actually do it, advocates and civil rights organizations are not going to back down on this.
I want to turn to a story that's been in national and regional news for those of us on the Cape Coast and Islands, and that's the idea of supervised injection sites. We've been hearing from Somerville's mayor, who says he wants to install one in his city regardless of the consequences. And then we did hear this week that a federal judge has ruled that those sites do not violate some federal laws, which has been the fear. And Somerville's mayor has also been looking to Beacon Hill for some help. So kind of tell us what's happening in light of this kind of new information with this federal judge.
Beacon Hill has been taking baby steps to get towards safe injection sites. There was a commission study that actually the Baker's Health and Human Services Secretary signed off on, saying that the state should pursue a pilot program for a supervised injection site. And of course, this is where someone could go and use intravenous drugs under medical supervision so they could be, you know, prevented from overdosing or revived after an overdose. What needs to happen for Somerville is the state needs to pass a law to allow the pilot program and to have guidance from the state saying this is how you comply. And you know, Somerville, Mayor Joe Quinn-Attorney, is dedicated to this. He said that he is looking to do it in 2020. We're not really looking at a raid situation where Joe Quinn-Attorney would open up the doors and then the FBI would come in. We're looking more of, you know, the fight happening in the courts before these places open, injunctions being, you know, executed and lifted before it goes on. So if we get to the point where doors are open, you can be fairly certain that the feds will be kind of satisfied in a way that this isn't wholly illegal, at least according to some courts.
And just briefly, Mike, today is payday for many throughout the Commonwealth. And folks, though, this week can expect a slightly smaller paycheck. That's because a new payroll tax to fund the state's Family and Medical Leave Act went into effect this week. Remind people what this is all about.
Yeah, this is a result of that grand bargain from a little while ago, about, you know, almost 2 years ago now, I should say, that raised the minimum wage and instituted a paid family and medical leave program for Massachusetts. So essentially, it's a new safety net. And usually these safety net programs get taken off on your paycheck side of things. And employers are also paying their share of this, but you will probably see it on your pay stub. This new tax essentially is paying, going towards a fund that you can then apply to if you need extended time off to care for a family member or a loved one. Right now, you kind of just got your sick days and that's about it. There's no medical leave program for family. If you, you know, got hit by a car, you yourself could be out. But if your spouse got hit by a car, you couldn't really take that as much time off to care for them. And that's something that a lot of people are you know, finding a need for more and more and more. And this is something that the legislature got done through that grand bargain scheme, where it was kind of a whole number of different issues at once. And Governor Baker signed it, even though it is a new tax. Baker says that it's a new program and it justifies the new tax, and it's kind of you get what you pay for kind of a deal, which sounds a lot like tax and spend to a lot of people. But again, it was the grand compromise, the grand bargain that you know was a few years ago. So now what is happening is this program is coming online. Baker did delay it a bit just to make sure that on the payroll side, on the Department of Revenue, they could take in or this new money and sort it out efficiently. But it is happening, and people will soon have the ability to apply to that fund to take time off to care for a loved one.
That is WCAI's State House reporter Mike Dean talking with us from Beacon Hill. Mike, thanks as always for checking in.
Great to be with you.
And that was WCAI's Catherine Iden speaking with our State House reporter Mike Dean. We have one more story to talk about today, and we're joined by WCAI morning producer Sam Houghton. Good morning, Sam.
Morning, Steve.
Sam, Mashpee held an election this week to fill a seat vacated by the late John Cahalan. David Whedon won, and it will be the first time a member of the Mashpee tribe will be a selectman in a decade. Tell us a little bit about this victory, and what did Whedon tell you about it?
Yeah, so I caught up with the morning after his victory, and first off, he's got a lot of homework to do. John Cahalan served the town for 20 years. He says he's got some big shoes to fill there. But I asked him, you know, what it meant to be kind of the first tribal member on the board in a decade, quite a bit. He kind of had an interesting answer. He said he tries not to think about it that way, but he says he was really inspired by some of the tribal members of the past. If you think of Mashpee, even over the last 20 years, the town has really grown a lot. It used to be mostly just tribal members. And Whedon told me that he likes to look through old annual town reports where you see the tribal members really ran the town back then. They made up all the boards and the committees. And Whedon says that he's trying to honor that commitment while he's serving on the board.
Tell us about how Whedon's policies might mix with the local politics there.
Yeah, well, his win comes at kind of an interesting time. Mashpee has been struggling to get its wastewater plans off the ground. I think a lot of towns are doing the same. You know, it's very expensive. But you have one member on the board now that's really pushing the town to start sewering. The remainder of the board is a little hesitant. You might have one or two here and there that are willing to go forward. But I think Whedon, he's really been an active voice for getting the town to protect its natural resources. That was kind of his main priority during his campaign. You know, the rivers, Wacoit and Pompanesset Bay, and the ponds are the towns, he's saying, are really their most important resources in Mashpee, and they've been heavily impacted by development. So I think it's going to be interesting to see him sitting on the board really pushing for that sewers to get moving forward.
Can you give us a little background on David Whedon? He didn't come out of the blue here.
No, so, yeah, interesting. He was actually on the Mashpee Planning Board for the last 3 years. He won a write-in candidacy a little ways back. And on the board, he really argued to keep development in check. This was a time Mashpee Commons started to look at expanding its shopping center, and Whedon was really an active voice calling for them to, you know, not go too far. The Commons had looked at adding some denser development with some taller buildings, maybe some people around the Cape aren't used to, and they were also, they own about three times more land than they have developed so far, so it could get really a lot bigger. And Whedon was, I'd say, a leading voice to keep the town's natural resources protected throughout those discussions. And kind of interesting enough, he lost a re-election campaign for the planning board in May. Strangely, that was the first contested race for the board in Mashpee for the planning board for a long time. So it's kind of interesting. So it seemed like maybe his stance might have gained some, you know, negative attention, some resistance. But then he ends up winning a seat on the Board of Selectmen this week, so maybe not after all.
He's also somewhat of a leader in the tribe, right?
Yeah. So he was elected the tribe's lead board, the tribal council, a few years back. And you know, I think it'll be interesting to have him on the town board at the same time. There's been what some might call, you know, a lack of communication between the tribe and the town for the last, you know, several years. And Whedon tells me he's really looking forward to having a voice for the tribe on the town's board.
That's WCAI morning producer Sam Houghton. Sam, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Steve.
And that is our news roundup for the week. I want to thank my guests. We had Sarah Mises-Tan from WCAI in the studio, along with Ethan Genter. On the phone, we spoke with Noah Asimow at the Vineyard Gazette, Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle, Ed Miller at the Provincetown Independent, Josh Balling at the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror, and Brian Dowd at the Martha's Vineyard Times. And we heard from Catherine Ident and Mike Dean talking State House news. I'm Steve Junker. Thank you for listening.